All right, so today's topic is the subject of vortices in a superconductor. We will discuss the mixed state in which both the superconducting order parameter and the magnetic field coexist. Yesterday we discussed how superconductivity dislikes the magnetic field, and the superconductor generally expels the magnetic field that is weak enough from its bulk, with some magnetic field penetrating at the surface. And we also saw that a strong enough magnetic field can kill superconductivity. So the two were engaged in mortal combat. Only one survived. Today we'll see a great example of how they can peacefully coexist. It turns out to be possible, and in fact, it was a brilliant work by Abrikosov in the 1950s. The lore is that Abrikosov went to his teacher Landau and said, "Teacher, look what I got." He found a solution for a periodic lattice of vortices in a superconductor. It's a really brilliant technically solution. And Landau looked at it and said, "Oh, it's too fancy. Probably doesn't work." And so Abrikosov didn't publish it initially, until there were reports that, in fact, the vortex lattice was observed experimentally. And here we have a very nice image of the Abrikosov vortex lattice that was obtained in 1967. There were indications that these vortices existed well before then, but this is an image which is obtained by basically dropping shavings of a magnetic material onto a superconductor. And if the magnetic field penetrates only at a few spots like here, then this is where the magnetic particles will gather. And so you can actually see, visualize this periodic lattice, which is a hexagonal lattice in this case, I think. A nice confirmation of the theory by Abrikosov. So all of these people who participated in the development of the phenomenological theory of superconductivity, Landau, Ginzburg, Abrikosov, they all got a Nobel Prize at one point or another. So this is very nice theoretical stuff, and so I will be happy to tell you how one can figure this all out. So we probably won't go as far as figure out why there is a triangular lattice specifically of vortices, but at least we'll see why there should be coexistence between the magnetic field and superconductivity. So this is the program for today. We'll start by discussing the surface tension of the superconducting normal boundary and take it from there. So a couple of reminders from yesterday's lecture. We discussed that there are two important length scales. So if we start with the Lagrangian at maybe the, at this point we don't need the Lagrangian, we just need the free energy, which had the covariant derivative term. Chemical potential term and an interaction term. Then we add to this the energy of the magnetic field and its coupling to an external current source. Right. So here we can cook up a couple of length scales just by dimensional analysis if we need to. One would be the healing length, also known as the coherence length. Xi, which is h bar divided by the square root of g, the concentration of Cooper pairs and the mass, And there's a second length scale, the penetration depth for the magnetic field. Was the 4 pi m0 e squared divided by mc squared. The other way around. So we will use both of these length scales today. So I want them to be on the board somewhere. So what we also determined from our analysis was that it's possible to have, in the presence of a magnetic field, two uniform states. One in which there is a superconducting order parameter, so we'll call it the superconducting state, where psi is non-zero, but B is zero because the magnetic field is expelled. So looking at that, you'll find that the energy density would be minus mu n plus 1/2 gn squared. And as you minimize this, you'll find that the equilibrium density would be determined by the ratio mu to g. And the energy density of the superconducting state would be minus 1/2 g m0 squared. These two terms are almost equal in magnitude, differ by a factor of half, and so this half is responsible for there being a minus sign here. There's a normal state in which the superconductivity is killed and the magnetic field is equal to the value of the applied field, right? The one that you intend to obtain. And so then u is going to be just the last two terms, b squared over 8 pi minus b dot h. You minimize this energy with respect to b. And then naturally, B would be equal to H. Right? So B is equal to H. And the energy of the normal state is simply minus H squared divided by 8 pi. So depending on which of these energies is lower, you will have one state or the other. If the magnetic field is weak, then this is better. If the magnetic state field is strong, then this state is better. Right? So the, one second, the critical field is determined by this condition that the superconducting condensation energy equals the energy density of the magnetic field. Yes?
Why isn't there a contribution from the first term? Is psi constant?
Yes, psi is a constant here, right? So psi is just square root of n times e to I theta, where theta is a constant number. So that's what we found yesterday. And at the end of the lecture, I posed the question about the coexistence of these two phases if you tune the field right to the critical value. So if the field is just HC, then the two phases have the exact same energy. And so you could imagine a situation where you have on the left the normal state and on the right the superconducting state. And so there's a straight interface separating them. So it will be an interesting state because you will have the wave function, well, the order parameter as a function of the distance across the interface. So it will be going from 0 to the saturation value of square root of n, 0. So, and it will be doing so over the distance of order the healing length C. And the magnetic field will be doing the opposite, going from the value of H, the applied magnetic field, down to zero in the bulk of the superconductor. And so this would be something like this over the magnetic penetration depth lambda. So that's the picture of the interface. The presence of this inhomogeneity will either increase the total energy or decrease the total energy. And so our first task today will be to determine what is the energy cost of this interface. If it's positive, then it means that the system doesn't like to have this interface. And if the interface is already present, nothing to do. We already have a normal state and a superconducting state. So there must be a boundary between them. This boundary will try to be as straight as possible to minimize the cost. On the other hand, if the boundary has a negative energy cost, then it would be a good idea for it to start wiggling, right? That increases the surface area. And if it starts wiggling, there's no telling what's going to happen, because it might start wiggling all over the system. And there may be new domain walls of this type coming up. And so you will end up with some sort of a mixture of the superconducting state and of the normal state. What kind of a mixture? This analysis will not tell us. And so we'll have to solve a more complicated problem in which both of these things coexist. And this is what Abrikosov did. So he found that the state minimizing the energy in certain cases would be a triangular lattice of magnetic vortices. But we don't want to solve a very complicated problem from the start, because we don't even know whether we need it. Right? So the first order of business is to make sure that we have to solve something more complex. Right? So one thing at a time. So let's first make sure that there can be situations where the surface tangent can be negative. Surface tangent is the energy of the interface per unit area. So here's the setup. This would be our y-axis, our x-axis, and the field will be along the z-direction. All right, so we'll assume that the normal phase is all the way to the left, the superconducting phase is all the way to the right, and then there is the intermediate region in between. So B points like this, and we'll assume that nothing depends on the coordinates y and z, and everything changes along the x direction. So psi depends on x, b, which is 0, 0, bz depends on x. And so this will simplify our problem, right? So we'll be dealing with something that's one-dimensional rather than three-dimensional. To do calculations, we need to choose a gauge, because B is not an independent field. It satisfies a constraint of zero divergence. So we have to specify a gauge in which we will work. So we'll choose the gauge to have just a y component that will also depend on x. And since BZ is partial xAy minus partial yAx, we're in luck, so it'll be just ay of x prime, the spatial derivative of ay. So we can do that. And so if we now specialize to this case, our expression for the energy will have the following form. Right, so the gradient will only have one component, ddx. ddy is 0, ddz is 0. Everything is uniform in those two directions. So we just need the x component of the gradient. And since the x component of the vector potential is absent, we just have psi prime squared, and that's that, right? Then there will be a y component of the vector potential, but there is no gradient component to marry it to. So we will have d over h bar c 1 over 2m, b divided by c a y times psi squared. And then, of course, the rest of the terms. So this is the contribution of the superconductor. The contribution of the magnetic field comes from Ay prime squared over 8 pi and minus Ay prime times h divided by 4 pi. All right, just to remind you, we will be working with h equal to the critical field. Right? So h is equal to hc. Because we don't want one of the phases to have a lower energy than the other, because in that case, the boundary will start shifting towards the higher energy phase, right? Because the energy will be decreased by doing so. So we don't want to push the boundary in any direction. This looks pretty complicated, right? And what we need to do now is to find exactly how the condensate amplitude and the magnetic field will depend on x. This is not a trivial problem. We can formally solve this problem, or at least attempt to, by minimizing the energy with respect to the fields psi and Ay. Right? So what we'll do is we'll calculate the functional derivatives of the potential energy with respect to psi, set it to 0, and the same for Ay. So what we will obtain will be what? Second-order differential equations, both for psi and for A, because there will be psi prime squared and there will be A prime squared. So it will be a complicated second-order differential equation. So let me write down one of them, maybe both. So the one for psi will include the following terms. So differentiating the first term gives me the something that looks like a kinetic energy in the Schrödinger equation, right? The second term will be something like a potential energy, E squared Ay squared divided by 2mc squared psi minus mu psi plus g psi squared times psi equal to 0. It's a second order differential equation, and it's complicated because Ay depends on x and we don't know exactly how. Right? So there's some sort of a potential term that represents a potential barrier or something like that. And for the gauge field, the situation is equally hopeless. We have minus Ay double prime over 4 pi from the first term. And from the second term, we get nothing. Right? This is a derivative to linear order. And so if we differentiate with respect to Ay prime, nothing is left, just a constant, which we have to differentiate with respect to x. Right? So this term does not contribute anything to the equations of motion. There's also this. And so we will have plus e squared psi squared divided by 2 mc squared times Ay equal to zero. So if psi were a constant number, right? If you dealt with a uniform superconductor, this would be easily solvable, right? You would find that AY decays exponentially, right? So that's the result that we previously obtained. So it's nice to see that it works out. Unfortunately, psi depends on X. And so again, we have a complicated problem. So we have to solve these two things together. Any idea how to do that? Solving second order differential equations is no fun, right? How about we make them first order differential equations? Wouldn't that be easier? Typically, we know how to solve first order differential equations, right? Is it possible to make them first order? Maybe if we can integrate them in some way, right? If there's a first integral or something like that. In fact, there is a nice analogy here between the procedure we've just done, which was minimizing a potential energy, right, or something like that, and minimizing the action in the classical mechanics, right? So there you just do a similar thing, and you obtain some equations of motion for a particle, for instance, right? So if you have something like that, where x depends on time, you will obtain the equations of motion. And the action density in this case would be the Lagrangian. Remember, action is Lagrangian over integrated over time, whereas here, potential energy is potential energy density integrated over space. So there's complete form of analogy between the two cases, right? And so if you look at the terms with the first derivative, if you replace the prime with the dot, the time derivative, this will be like a kinetic energy term. This will be like a potential energy term, right, in the Lagrangian. Again, this would be kinetic energy, and this would be neither kinetic nor potential. This would be a Berry phase term, because it's linear in the time derivative, right? So if we have a Lagrangian that contains kinetic energy minus potential energy, and neither of them depends on time explicitly, then we know that there is a first integral that is constant in time. What is the first integral? Energy, right? So we know that ddt of k plus u is zero. So we can just apply the same line of reasoning to this horrific expression for the energy. We just declare this a kinetic term, this also a kinetic term. The rest of them we will declare potential terms, and we'll ignore this part. And then we just flip the sign of the potential term, and the resulting superposition will be constant in x. So that's going to be h bar squared psi prime squared over 2m plus e squared ay prime squared divided by, sorry, just ay prime squared divided by 8 pi. And then we subtract the potential terms So thereby we've integrated this once. So now I can erase the sign of the derivative here and just replace the zero on the right hand side with a constant. So we need to figure out what this constant is, right? If we want to use this equation. And we can do so by going towards either x equal to plus infinity when we know there is a uniform superconducting phase, or to minus infinity when there is a uniform normal phase. So let's do the superconducting one. As x goes to plus infinity, this term vanishes because psi is uniform, so it doesn't depend on x. This term vanishes because there is no magnetic field in the bulk of the superconductor. Right. If we choose the gauge in such a way that Ay is zero in the at x equal to infinity, then this term will vanish as well. And finally, we just get these two terms. So this term is mu times n zero, and this is minus 1/2 g n zero squared. So we know that they add up to 1/2 g n naught squared. If we go to minus infinity, we'll find a similar conclusion. The first term is absent because there's no superconductor there. The second term survives. We have Ay prime, which is bz, just equal to the critical field. The next term vanishes. In fact, all the other terms vanish because there's no psi. And so this is going to be h squared c divided by 8 pi. So that's consistent, right? So we know these two numbers are equal. Up to a sign, these are the energy densities of the superconducting state and the normal state. Okay. So we're not actually going to solve this, but we're going to use this to simplify our predicament, analyzing this rather horrific expression for the interface energy density. Right. So I'm going to get rid of some of the ugliest terms. And by that, I mean the potential energy terms. So I'm going to use the trick to express this part in terms of something that I find more aesthetically pleasing, namely the terms with the derivatives. You can see where I'm going, because what I want to do is to analyze the energy that's non-zero only at the interface, right? And so the variation of the wave function happens only in the vicinity of the interface, and so on, right? So I can just express these terms. Right? So roughly speaking, u, k plus u is the energy. And so I'm just expressing the potential term through the total energy and the kinetic terms in the language of the Lagrangian time dependence. So in other words, I can express this thing in terms of that. Right. So then my density of the free energy is going to have this term and that term. And then the next three terms will be replaced with the following. Right, so my minus mu psi squared plus 1/2 g psi to the fourth plus Ay prime squared over 8 pi. According to this, they will be equal to h bar squared psi prime squared divided by 2m. And sorry, no, I don't want to express this. So I need to get rid of that part. So I've taken these to the right, and I'm moving the right-hand side to the left. So I'll have minus hc squared over 8 pi here. So with this, my energy density simplifies. This term and that term will simply double. Right. Then I subtract AY prime H and also that term. And to make it slightly more physical, let me come back from AY prime to the magnetic field that it represents. So that's going to be h bar squared psi prime squared divided by m plus bz times bz minus h critical over 4 pi. And minus hc squared over 8 pi. Now this is something I can live with now. And I'm going to start analyzing this. With one more technical step before that. So what I'm going to do is erase the absolute value here and declare that I can choose psi to be a real field. Can be made real. And you can see that if you look at the Schrödinger equation for psi at the very top of the blackboard. So there are no i's there, no imaginary units. And so you can actually solve it in terms of a completely real field, right? So therefore, I don't need to take care of its complex nature. It's a real field. Okay, so if you look at these three terms, you can see that they nicely fall apart into something that I can digest. This is the energy density of the uniform phases, either the superconducting one or the normal one. They're the same and they're equal to this, right? So this is our starting point essentially, right? So the normal phase or the superconducting phase will give you this energy. And in our further analysis, we actually need to discard this term because we're computing the energy relative to the ground states. So this is the ground state energy. And we should subtract it if we're interested in the interface energy alone. The interface energy comes from these two terms, as you can easily see, because psi has zero derivative on the left in the normal state. And it has zero derivative on the right in the superconducting state. So all its variation is happening in the region of width c. For this term, there's a similar story. The field goes the other way. And the nice part here is that this term vanishes again, both on the left-hand side and on the right-hand side. Because on the left, bz is equal to hc. And on the right, bz is 0. So this product vanishes. And it's only non-zero again in this transitional region of width lambda. Now, and here's the kicker. What's the sign of this term? It's positive, right? So this is positive definite, and it can only increase the interface energy. How about this term? It's negative, because although BZ is positive, BZ minus HC is negative, right? So we're only going up to, but not above, the applied field value. So this is positive, this is negative. And so depending on which of the two terms dominates, you will find that the energy is either positive, if this is the dominant term, or negative if that is the dominant term. So now this is not an academic question anymore, whether the interface energy is positive or negative. It's strange to have an interface costing negative energy, but sometimes it happens. It happens often when you're dealing with long-range interactions, and here we are dealing with long-range interactions. They're mediated by the long-range magnetic field. There are other systems in which that also happens. Sometimes you can have ferromagnet domain walls that cost negative energy, and they proliferate, and you have an interesting mixed state too. Okay, so let's now estimate the magnitude of these as we integrate the energy over x to obtain the interface energy. So we're going to integrate over x the following quantity. It's the energy density minus the energy density of the ground state. So that's dx times the first two terms over there. So we're just going to estimate, not to make an exact evaluation. So this term is of order minus hc squared over 4 pi, right? That's the magnitude. It's set by the scale, and it exists in an interval of width lambda. So we'll just estimate it like that. The first term has the magnitude of h bar squared, superconducting density divided by 2m c squared, because psi prime is roughly square root of m divided by xi. Right? That's the distance over which the order parameter varies. And so you multiply it by xi. That's the width. So these are the magnitudes of these two terms. So I'm going to transform this term a little bit to make it comparable to this more easily. So h bar squared times n divided by m psi squared. I'll just write down the definition of psi. That was h bar squared, and then upstairs we'll have G, N, and M. Right, so the mass cancels out. H bar squared cancels out. And we'll obtain something like G, N0 squared. And so gn0 squared is the same as hc squared over 4 pi. So I can rewrite this term as hc squared over 4 pi times c. So now you can see how the competition works out. The surface tension is hc squared over 4 pi times c minus lambda. Right. Before breaking out the champagne, I just want to check that my result makes sense. I'm computing surface tension, which is energy per unit area. H squared over a number is energy density per unit volume. You multiply it by a length, so you get the right units. So this tells you everything. If you have a superconductor with a long healing length and a short magnetic penetration depth, then this is positive. Right? These are known as type 1 superconductors. Lambda over C, if this quantity is, in our analysis, if it's greater than 1, sorry, lambda over C less than 1. But if one does a better calculation, it turns out to be 1 over square root of 2, which is the boundary between them, then sigma is positive and coexistence is assured. Right, so interfaces cost positive energies, and so you don't want interfaces at all, as few as possible. And so this is where mortal combat actually happens. You either have the normal state or the superconducting state, but not both at the same time. Only when you tune the field to H critical. So there's a single critical field. At which the switch happens. And these are mostly elemental superconductors that contains a single element, metals, lead, aluminum, whatever you want. Type 2 superconductors have a shorter correlation length, coherence length, than the magnetic length. And so this is greater than 1 over square root of 2. In this case, sigma is less than 0. And so there should be a mixed state. Okay. Questions? So we know that it's not going to be going directly from the normal state to the superconducting state. There should be some sort of a mixed state in between. And the transition happens in two stages, it turns out. As you start from zero field, turn on a little bit of the field, it'll be first expelled. But then at some point, you will have single vortices penetrating into the superconductor. So the picture would be the superconductor will have mostly its superconducting state intact, but there will be occasionally places where superconductivity is killed, right? So at the vortex core, the superconducting order parameter will vanish just like in this, it does in the superfluid, right? So you'll have a vortex here where the phase basically changes as you go around by 2 pi. So as you make one revolution, the phase of the order parameter changes by 2 pi. And this has interesting consequences. It means that by the same argument that we used yesterday, if you determine how much magnetic flux is contained within this vortex, what will be the number? Remember our argument that in the bulk of the superconductor where everything is OK, the current is 0. since there is no magnetic field. Its curl is zero, and so we had a nice result that the circulation of the vector potential would be hc divided by e multiplied by the phase change divided by 2 pi, which was an integer, right? And so if this is 1 for a single vortex, then we'll end up with a single quantum of magnetic flux, right? So this would be 1 or maybe minus 1. And so it turns out that each vortex, which is, if it's well isolated from other vortices, it carries exactly 1 quantum of magnetic flux, right? So this hole is basically where the order parameter vanishes. So that's an area of order psi. And in a type 2 superconductor, lambda is much longer. So the magnetic field will live in a wider area like this, and it will also die down away from that. So you will have a vortex here, you'll have a vortex there. Their cores and their magnetic fields will not overlap. They'll be far apart. That's the picture, at least when lambda over xi is much greater than 1. Extreme type 2 superconductor. There are many of those. So the famed cuprate superconductors that have the highest transition temperatures, discovered in the 1980s, they are extreme type 2 superconductors. So they have the nice Abrikosov vortex in them. So this is the picture, the qualitative picture at the transition from the normal state to the mixed state, sorry, from the superconducting state to the mixed state. If you go from the other extreme, you're in the normal state and you're coming down in the field, right? So you're reducing the field. Initially, superconductivity is suppressed, but eventually it will appear and the magnetic field will be mostly uniform, but there will be some modulation of that. And so generally, this modulation of the magnetic field will develop into a triangular lattice of these vortices. So let me try to estimate the two critical fields at which the transitions happen. The lower critical HC1, which happens as you go from the normal, sorry, superconducting state to a state with a few vortices. So in order to determine when that happens, we have to think about the energy of a single vortex. So let me write down the expression for the energy. And I'm going to concentrate on the variations of phase. So if I write it in the same way I did previously, so we'll have variations of the length of the order parameter. Then there'll be a coupling of theta to the gauge field. So it's going to be a lot of terms, but fortunately, I only need to concentrate on a couple of them, namely this, the energy associated with the changes in the phase, and also that. Right, so if you write down the minimization with respect to angle theta, you will have so, or you just concentrate on the angular contribution to the energy. It will look just like that of a superfluid, except that there is a coupling to the gauge field. Right, if not for this part, if not for the coupling to the gauge field, this would be a similar story to a superfluid in which grad theta scales as 1 over r. As you go away from the vortex, the gradient decreases in magnitude in inverse proportion to the distance, right? It changes by 2 pi over the distance equal to the circumference, 2 pi r, and hence that. And so this would be h bar squared, the density divided by 2m, and then times 1 over r squared. If you attempt to integrate this over the transverse dimensions, x and y, you will encounter a logarithmic singularity, right? So it would be something like pi h bar squared and 0, and then an integral of dr over r. So we have to cut this off somewhere, in fact, at both ends, right? And so our correlation length, or the healing length, comes to the rescue at the lower end, because that's where the order parameter vanishes. And so effectively, this coefficient n0 becomes 0. So that provides the lower distance cutoff. Now, the 64k question is, what is the upper cutoff? Previously, it was the size of the system. What about now? Well, that's one good guess. Anything else? How about the penetration depth? Remember, deep in the superconductor, there's no current. The field vanishes, right? The current vanishes. This is our current. And so this term just kills the gradient of the phase. And that happens as the magnetic field recovers, or the magnetic field dies out, right? So in the vortex, this would be the upper cutoff. And so you will have pi h bar squared m0 divided by m times the logarithm of the ratio of these two lengths. Actually, so I have these quantities. I don't want to erase them. So according to our calculation, the energy of a vortex in zero magnetic field has this cost. And this cost is positive, right? Lambda is greater than xi, so the logarithm is a positive number. So we have a positive energy cost for creating a vortex and killing psi at the core and twisting theta costs h bar squared n divided by n times pi times the logarithm lambda over c. It's greater than zero. What offsets this is the b dot h term, which is negative. So we integrate over the cross section, this term, minus b dot h, divided by 4 pi, which, since h is a constant in space, is basically the integral of b. That's the flux carried by the vortex. That's minus h over 4 pi times the total flux. And in this case, it's just the flux unit, the flux quantum, and the field is equal to the critical field. So we just have to compare these two quantities, one positive, one negative. Sorry, this is h. There should be an m, yes. So both quantities have the units of energy per unit length. We integrated over two dimensions, but there's a third dimension. So vortices are lines. So there's an energy cost per unit centimeter, per unit length. So once the field becomes large enough, the negative contribution, the Zeeman energy, if you will offset the positive energy cost of creating a vortex. And so the critical field will be something like 4 pi over phi naught times h bar squared n divided by m times this logarithm. This is known as the lower critical field, hc1. And if you do the math, this would be phi 0 divided by 4 pi lambda squared times the logarithm of lambda over c. Right. If you compare it to the previous critical field we estimated when you have a transition, the discontinuous transition from the normal, from the superconducting to the normal state, hc is in the same units, phi 0 divided by 2 pi lambda c. And so this is much greater than hc1, because comparing these two quantities, you replace lambda squared in the denominator with lambda c, where c is a shorter length. Right. So forget the logarithm for now, and so we'll get something like that. So the transition from the superconducting state to the inclusion of some magnetic field happens much earlier than we thought it would. So instead of killing superconductivity outright, the system finds it more convenient to kill superconductivity in a few places and let the magnetic field go through, because vortex creation is cheap in a type 2 superconductor. A short coherence length indicates that it's easy to kill the order parameter. And so why not kill the order parameter at a few spots and let some magnetic field through? So that's the logic. Let's also estimate the upper critical field. hc2, which is you're going from a high field and you're in a normal state, superconductivity is killed outright. And you're entering the mixed state in which you have a non-zero psi and a non-zero b. So in order to facilitate that, I'll write again the density of energy psi minus IE over h bar CA psi squared minus mu psi squared plus 1/2 g psi to the fourth, and then plus the magnetic part, which I actually won't need. So I'm going to analyze the situation when psi is very small. The superconductivity is very weak. It's absent in the higher field, and it's barely present in the lower field. And so the effects of screening expelling the magnetic field are going to be extremely weak, and that's why my magnetic field is going to be approximately equal to the applied field and uniform. So I don't need to think about minimization of the magnetic field energy. It's pretty much that. So the only thing I need to do is minimize the energy with respect to the water parameter. And so I'll obtain something that looks like a Schrodinger equation, right? This term gives rise to the covariant derivative squared term, grad minus IE over h bar CA squared times psi minus mu psi. And this gives a nonlinear term plus g psi squared times psi equal to 0. This is known as the nonlinear Schrodinger equation in applied mathematics. And there are mathematicians basically spending their lives studying this equation. You have nice solitons and so on. I'm going to ignore this term. Why am I allowed to do that? Because psi is small, right? So if I'm examining how the transition from zero psi to a small psi happens, I can ignore this term, at least at first. And with that, it just becomes the Schrodinger equation of a particle in a magnetic field. And you can think of mu as the eigenvalue of energy. So it's just a Schrodinger equation like this. Minus h bar squared over 2m equals mu psi. The vector potential corresponds to a uniform magnetic field. So this is a problem that you may have previously seen. Landau levels, right? Ring the bell? Good. So what are the energy levels of this problem? What will mu be? Right, so you introduce the Larmor frequency, which is E times H over MC. And the energy levels will be h bar omega times n plus 1/2, like a harmonic oscillator. Right? So we'll be discussing these energy levels tomorrow, in fact, in the quantum Hall business. And so the lowest energy level would be mu equal to h bar omega over 2. And that's the one that we will need. So in fact, we know what mu is, right? Mu is g times n0, where n0 is the equilibrium density. So it's actually fixed for us. And so this solution, although formally we can write it, but it doesn't exist for any possible value of the field. So you have to tune the field specifically to that value, some specific value. Right. So in fact, this gives us the field in which the nucleation of the superconducting water parameter happens first. Right. So this just tells us that we have h bar over 2 times EH over MC, and that determines the critical value of the field. So as you come down in this field, all of a sudden the system realizes that it provides a solution to the Schrodinger equation like this. So you can have an order parameter that satisfies this equation at that value of the field. As you lower the field further, your order parameter grows, and you can no longer ignore this cubic term. So it'll be a modified equation, and then you can try and solve it, and this is what Abrikosov did. And he found that there was a nice lattice of vortices, a triangular lattice. But I think we've accomplished enough today. So we've figured out what happens in the type 2 superconductor, and we determined both upper and lower critical fields. So let me say a few words about the upper critical field. Oh, I can use that one. So HC2, once you do the calculation, will turn out to be simply pi 0 divided by pi xi squared. So for one thing, this is much higher than HC1 because it has c in the denominator, which is much shorter than lambda in our case, right? So you have a large range of the fields between HC1 and HC2 where the mixed state exists. As you go from below, magnetic field is fully expelled. Then you have a few vortices, few and far between. And then eventually the vortices, their number increases because you're accommodating more and more magnetic field. Each vortex carrying one flux quantum, you have to make more vortices. So the vortices crowd around. And if you look at this, it tells you that the density of vortices is roughly 1 per healing length squared. And so it means that the vortices are overlapping not just with their magnetic fields, which are spilling out far, and so the magnetic field becomes pretty much uniform at that point, but also the cores of the vortices are starting to overlap, right? So you have holes with the diameter of xi, or the radius of xi, and they're almost overlapping. And so this is a point where you might as well give up and say, well, there are so many holes in the superconductor, it's not holding up anymore. And so you enter the normal state. So that's the picture. So in the range of the fields between HC1 and HC2, you have this mixed state, which is usually a triangular lattice of vortices. Your sample is a little bit disordered, then this triangular arrangement may be disrupted. You might have some irregular patterns, but in the best samples, a triangular lattice is what you observe. Questions?
So suppose we raise the temperatures, like, and we just consider superconductors without applying an external magnetic field. So if we use the analogy with like helium, we will say, so is it possible to create vortices and
anti-vortices? Vortices and anti-vortices will be created, but it turns out that the death of the superconductor happens not because there are lots of vortices. It's because thermal agitation disrupts the very bosons that have been created in the first place. Right? In a superfluid, in helium, bosons are very robust, right? So it takes energies of electron volts to break them apart. But in a superconductor, these are pairs of electrons. And they hold together by a rather feeble force mediated by phonons. And so if you agitate a sample thermally, the thing that happens first is not that vortices proliferate, but Cooper pairs break up. And so that's a rather mundane transition compared to the one that happens in liquid helium.
Vortices and vortices will also carry magnetic flux, like by by itself. There'll be like some internal like magnetic field created by superconductors.
Yeah, yeah.
So it will be kind of weird, yes?
Yeah, so if you ask this question in the 1970s or early 80s, people would just look at you like you're a nut, because everyone knows that the Cooper pairs are very fragile. But in the 80s, with the discovery of high-TC superconductors, the situation changed. And in fact, for a long while, there was speculation that it's precisely what happens in high-temperature superconductors. The Cooper pairs are very robust, and what happens is you raise temperature. You end up with thermal fluctuations developing waves and vortices and eventually scrambling the Bose field. Whether or not that actually happens is still subject of vigorous debate in the high temperature community, but it's at least a viable scenario, yes. All right. So we'll have one last lecture tomorrow on the subject of the quantum Hall effect.